Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Mark Sisson is an American fitness author, food blogger, and a former distance runner, triathlete, and Ironman competitor. He is one of the leading authorities when it comes to paleo or primal, low-carb, ketogenic, and overall well-being. To learn more about Mark Sisson, visit his website at primalblueprint.com. That's PRIMALBLUEPRINT.com.
Mark, how are you, mate? And thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Hey, Pete, I'm great. And it's great to be here with you. It's been a while since we last conversed.
Yeah, I think the last time we conversed, we were actually cooking a mean steak together in your home in Malibu. that was a great day.
And you remember the incident with the calf back of my leg?
I remember you got a little bit burnt, I think it was.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a good steak though, man. It was an awesome steak.
Yeah, I remember it. Actually, for sure. I think that episode has just come out onto Netflix, actually, around.
Oh, wow.
In the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK even. We finally got it out there. It only took us a couple of years, but if anyone wants to watch it, check out the Paleo A series too, and check out Mark's cooking skills.
My mad cooking skills, as they would say here.
Brother, it's such an honor having you on the podcast because I've been eating this way and my family's been eating this way for on about 7 to 8 years now. And you were one of the inspiring, I guess, forces to that transition for us, because I would jump onto Mark's Daily Apple every single day and read all your forums, read all your blogs, get a really good understanding of how the science of eating a primal / paleo / ketogenic low carb, or as people say, just eating real food approach can change not only people's bodies, but also their minds and their energy levels and everything like that. And so I just want to thank you for your dedication to all of that content that you put out there for so many people, because you made our transition process very easy, because we could always, if somebody asked a question, we could say, hey, just go and have a read of Mark's blog on this today. And what I loved about your, I guess, the tone and the way that you presented it, it was backed with a lot of science, but it also wasn't too steadfast. You sort of had that approach where, hey, this works for me. This is the science behind it. Give it a shot, but don't be too rigid in it. So thank you for that. And I want to talk about how you actually started to create Mark's Daily Apple back in the day.
Well, you know, it's first of all, appreciate the accolades, and I'm I'm very proud to have been an early adopter of this way of eating and continue to obviously go down that road and continue to do research, look at ways in which we can all be, you know, fit and happy and healthy and productive. you know, the initial impetus here was I had a supplement company and I was selling vitamin and mineral supplements for athletes and really people who were really interested in high performance. And I grew that company based largely on appearances that I made on television. I would go on these little talk shows in the US and I would be an expert in diet and exercise and training and fitness. And I was an ex-coach and I had a lot of knowledge in different areas. And oh, by the way, I have these great vitamins. You should maybe try them. That business model worked very well for about 7 years. And then something happened in the United States with the convergence of 300 cable channels and the internet and a diminution, if you will, of people's interest in infomercial type things. And I had to kind of pivot and I thought, well, how am I going to create a market for my products? You know, and I'm good at creating content, but geez, television is so, as you know, Pete, television is wickedly expensive.
Yeah.
Both in terms of producing it and then buying airtime. So I thought, well, I'll try my hand at this new blogging thing. This sounds like fun. And so in 2006, I started Mark's Daily Apple, basically to espouse all these different ideas I had about how to live awesomely, how to be fit, how to exercise right, how to eat right. Started out even with a little bit of emphasis on supplements. And within a very short period of time, as I dug deeper into the research and started looking more and more into ancestral health and the paleo movement was just coming on to the forefront, everything that I'd been studying for the previous 30 years sort of coalesced into this life way that I called the Primal Blueprint. And it was really based on kind of the emerging science of genetics, which we hadn't really paid that much attention to up to then. So I took a look at how evolution informed our choices and how modern genetic science could prove that if you adopted some of these lifestyle behaviors of our ancestors, you would actually manifest a renewed, regenerated, recreated body based on genetic signals. And a lot of those signals obviously come from food, but some come from sleep. Some come from the choice of exercises that you choose to do. Some come from sun exposure. And I started to look at all of these hidden genetic switches that we all have that we could access and that I could maybe provide some insights to people into, you know, how they could tap into this amazing genetic potential that we all have. But unfortunately, that we've all kind of screwed up through modern living. So that was a real kind of the impetus behind Mark's Daily App in the first place.
So that was 12 years ago, give or take. And through the last 12 years, I see that you are still a proud proponent of the Primal lifestyle. You're actually training people at the moment and you have a wonderful program that's out there at the moment. I'd love to tap into that just for a second to talk about where you're at this present time in your career and what you're doing for the planet.
Well, you may have heard that my food company, Primal Kitchen, has recently been acquired by Kraft Heinz.
Wow.
We are very excited about that. And that offers now a whole new level of access. You know, my goal in the past 5 or 6 years has been to change the way the world eats. So sort of continuing off the story of how I started Mark's Daily Apple, what I found as I went further and further down that path, I was writing more and more about food. Food became sort of this main thing that, look, you got to get your food right. If you don't get your food right, then it doesn't matter how much meditation you do or how much yoga you do or how much exercise you do, you're not going to maximize all of these health opportunities that you have. So I was writing a lot about food. But what I recognized only 4 years ago was but a lot of the foods I was writing about were, again, real food, you know, access to foods that don't have added sugar, that don't have industrial seed oils in them, that don't use processed grains or any grains at all, for that matter. And I realized that nobody was making those kinds of foods, those kinds of condiments and dressings and things that you put on food to make it taste better and maybe impart some healthfulness to it in the process. So I started Primal Kitchen, and Primal Kitchen, which is only about 4 years old right now, has grown to be one of the top better for you food companies in the U.S. And just about 3 weeks ago, we announced that Kraft Heinz will be purchasing it from us. And what that means is that now we'll be able to have the same products that we've been making for the last 4 years with the same ingredients and, you know, all of the same standards, but now with a much larger platform in terms of distribution, in terms of economies, in terms of scale and marketing and all the things that sort of can tie up an emerging company, you know, as they grow and grow and grow and expand. So very excited about that. So that's when you say, what are we doing for the world? That's one of the things that I'm most excited about is this being able to give access to more and more people the sorts of products that I think they ought to be putting on their salads and putting on their steaks and putting on their chicken and making their tuna salad with and making their chicken salad with and so on and so forth. So that's, I just want to wrap that up a little bit. Now, to your point about the educational thing, I also, a bunch of years ago, I created a mission statement that said I want to change the lives of 10 million people. Well, I think about 4 or 5 years into that, we'd already kind of hit that number. And so I had to add a zero to my goals there. And then it became 100 million people. So in order to do that, we really have to leverage what I call the technology, leverage the knowledge base. And so I created the Primal Health Coach Institute. The Primal Health Coach Institute is basically an online learning experience where people can become certified as a primal health coach and basically do what I do in terms of working with people, whether it's one-on-one, whether it's at the corporate level, you know, whether it's in a medical setting as a nurse practitioner or, you know, a physician's assistant, spending time with a patient in that case, but spending time with people and coaching them on guiding them in ways in which they can tap into this knowledge about how to eat better, how to exercise appropriately, how to get the right amount of sleep, how to dial in, you know, the amount of sun exposure that might be best for you, all manner of different lifestyle and behavioral choices that people find themselves up against, but find themselves also very confused about. So we put this all into a very robust program. It's 20 basic chapters on this. You have to, each module, we call the chapters modules, but each of the modules, you have to take a test and pass it before you go on to the next module. We've had about 3,000 people enroll in the course and about, I think over 2,000 have gone through it already. And people are just loving it and thinking it's, you know, very, very useful information, not just for themselves, but in the event that they want to maybe make a career of being a health coach.
Congratulations, mate. I love it and I can't wait to get stuck into it as well. I'm going to do it. But I just want to step back into the foods and I guess the acquisition with Heinz there, because it's interesting because I guess there's a notion out there in the health community that multinational food corporations are evil and this sort of thing. And I've never had, I guess, thought about it, that for me, it's always just been business. How can companies create something for the cheapest possible price, probably so that they get volume, but also have a margin there to make money. I guess that's what every business operates on. But I always had the belief that as soon as health becomes people's number one priority, that the businesses all around the globe will adapt to that supply and demand of the consumer. And in this case, this is a perfect example of it. And I'd love to get your take on it because you've just done this. And obviously now you can get products to a much, much larger audience, which is always the goal, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, you know, people have asked me for the longest time, how do you intend to reach tens of millions of people or 100 million people? And I said, well, I'm not going to do it by giving my blog URL away with a business card every time I meet someone. And I'm probably not going to do it with books that I write, even though I'd love to sell millions and millions of copies. How it happens is through making products that people are attracted to. And I think the greatest testimonial I've gotten in the last year is people who come up, I meet people and, you know, this sort of standard, hey, how are you doing? What's your name? What do you do? And I say, well, I have a food company. Oh, what's your food company? Well, it's called Primal Kitchen. Oh my gosh. I buy that product. Okay. So you know who I am, right? You know, Mark and Mark's Daily Apple and all that. No, never heard of you. I just picked it up off the shelf, looked at the label, saw that it was clean ingredients, real food ingredients, and thought, I've been looking for this my whole life. That's the biggest testimonial that I've gotten. And that is what large multinational food companies are starting to recognize. they, over the past 10 years, as there's been a greater interest among the consumers in better for you products, where consumers have been reading labels and being very discerning about what they buy, there's been a decrease in market share of some of the brands that we all grew up with. Some of those brands that we may have made fun of in the ancestral health world, right? Some of the ones that have, you know, artificial ingredients or too much sugar or soybean oil or canola or corn oil in them. We've sort of, you know, made a lot of fun of these products, but this is all that people had access to until just a few years ago. And so what these companies are recognizing now is that there is a very discerning customer base, people who want, who are willing to pay a little bit more for exceptional ingredients. And this is what Kraft Heinz saw with us. They saw a trend that they wanted to get on very early, because this is where people are voting with their dollars. You know, people who, the big corporations, you know, they have shareholders that they're beholden to, and they have to appease, and they have to show profitability. But that doesn't mean that they can't make great products. It just means that they have to, that there's a new area that they have to be playing in a big way to take advantage of this emerging marketplace. And that's what Kraft Heinz have done here. So when people say, oh, geez, aren't you worried about the brand? It's going to, you know, aren't they going to find ways in which to use less than ideal ingredients? And like, no, the reason they're acquiring us is because we're teaching them how to make a product that is great tasting and also uses the best possible ingredients with no compromises. So I think it's very exciting, because we've had in our research, we've had access to some new materials that they've never heard of, that are, you know, I wouldn't say exotic, but they're, that are natural and unrefined and non-GMO or organic, that will make for some great new products. So we're going to have a blast creating new, what we call innovative new products.
Well, I take my hat off to you, mate, because the products, and thank you for the packages over the last year, because the sauces and the dressings that you have are exceptional. And I've had the same with some of my own products that I've released into the marketplace. My own philosophy is, you know, here's a solution or an opportunity for people that do care about their health, and for them to have an alternative on the shelves. And obviously there'll always be, I guess, as you said, the ones that we've always grown up with, and that will always probably be a part of the shopping centres. But isn't it great these days that they're at the big supermarkets and the big chains, or, and as you said, the multinationals, and now having the guts and the nous to actually put something on the shelves that is an option for people. And once we have those options, then that's where the education can start, and that's when the emphasis or the ownership can come back on the public to make their own decisions.
No, for sure. I mean, we just introduced, I don't know if you tried our ketchup yet, Pete, but we just introduced, you have?
It's great. Yeah. It's fantastic. And your mustard.
So, yeah. But here's the thing. So mustard's easy. I don't want to downplay the mustard. Mustard's easy. But ketchup was a problem that no one had solved for. And for the last 10 years, there's been all of this, you know, brouhaha about high fructose corn syrup that's in ketchup, and how it's impossible to make a ketchup that is organic and unsweetened and tastes great. That's why they use high fructose corn syrup. That's why they use artificial sweeteners and preservatives and everything else. And we solved that problem when we made a ketchup that is organic, unsweetened, and tastes great. And I think that's a perfect example of where, for instance, mothers who have children, mothers have read about ketchup and high fructose corn syrup, and they've been, you know, almost to a fault, like very afraid to give their kids ketchup, even though the kids want ketchup and they want to have their chips and they want to have their, you know, their burgers and their hot dogs or whatever. But that's been a real gap in the marketplace until we introduced this new ketchup. And now moms are loving the ketchup. They feel great about giving it to their kids. There's no guilt at all in that. And I think, you know, if you talk to a lot of mothers are like, they're the ones that are doing the purchasing for the family, right? They're the keepers of the family's health. That's a big responsibility. And with it comes a lot of potential burden and guilt. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, unburden these mothers of having to make those sorts of momentous decisions by offering products that they feel really good about giving their kids.
Mm. Yeah, I love it, mate. And it's interesting to hearing you talk about that, that it was an impossible task. But I'm sure that if we went back through history, it's a very simple recipe that was made with real ingredients at one point in time before it became...
Go figure, right?
Yeah. which I guess is your philosophy and the ancestral movement's philosophy is, let's take a look back at what has supported human beings over the course of our evolutionary history. And it's not that hard. And I want to ask you that question now, because you've been in this industry and you've been at the forefront of it for so long. Do you believe there is a simple formula for human beings all across the world at any age, you know, from childhood onwards, that if they want to basically have a healthy life, do you believe there's a simple formula? And if so, what is it?
Interestingly, Pete, that's the first time anybody's really asked me that question in that context. Mm-hmm. And I have an answer for it, which is yes, there's a simple formula, and it's eat real food. And mm-hmm. if you stick by that and eat real food, you cannot go wrong, no matter what your genetic predisposition to being overweight, to being diabetic, to having heart disease or whatever. You can't go wrong if you eat real food. Now, you still have to be mindful that, like, you know, natural organic honey is real food, but you can't like eat a gallon of honey and expect to be in good shape. But I think, first of all, and how we stair step people into this lifestyle is we say, okay, there's some things that you probably should avoid. You know, you should avoid sugary, sugar added, sweetened beverages, pies, cakes, candies, cookies. I mean, I don't want to tell people they can never have those, but you know, we all know that those aren't the healthiest possible foods. And if we're looking for a simple solution, one solution is just to eliminate all those. Get rid of grains. I think everybody would be well served to do at least a 30-day experiment where they eliminate all grains and see how they feel. Most people feel demonstrably better, noticeably better. And so you can deduce that something in the grains was probably causing an issue. Now, the question is, how bad of an issue was it? In my case, I have to stay away from wheat or I get really in trouble. Not so much corn, but I still stay away from most grains. The other thing is industrial seed oil. So if we talk about eliminating corn oil, soybean oil, canola oil, these oils, I think, are probably the most problematic thing in the standard Australian or standard American diet. Mm-hmm. I think they're much more problematic than people have ever kind of recognized. And by eliminating those industrial seed oils and sticking with high quality fats, avocado oil, olive oil, ghee, butter, lard to a certain extent, then I think you've gotten 80% of where you need to be in terms of eating real food. And then if you just eat meat, pastured meat, chicken, fat, you know, eggs, nuts, seeds, lots of vegetables and a little bit of fruit, you cannot go wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, recently, and when I say can't go wrong, I say you can't go wrong in achieving optimal health. Now, does that mean you're going to lose all the weight that you've spent 40 years accumulating? Maybe, maybe not. If you want to lose the weight, now we have to talk about additional strategies, not just real food, but maybe how much you eat and when you eat and how you mix the macronutrients in a way that optimizes your body's metabolism so you achieve what we call metabolic flexibility. That's been the new word in this community for the last 2 years. The concept of metabolic flexibility, which basically means that instead of just relying on carbohydrate and glycogen and glucose to get you through every day, to get you from one meal to the next, you develop a skill which allows you to derive energy from fat, whether it's fat on your plate or fat on your body. You can derive energy from the ketones that your liver makes by diverting some of that fat to the liver. You can also get energy from glucose or glycogen from either your muscles or from the food on your plate. And to a certain extent, you can even burn a little protein once in a while, but you develop metabolic flexibility so that you're never out of energy. You're never hangry or hungry for the next meal 2 hours after finishing the last meal. That's really the strategy that I think takes the real food initial concept and then refines it to a way that allows the person to intuitively understand how much food is enough. That's a really bizarre concept for a lot of people. Like, how much food is enough, Pete? I mean, geez, Chef Evans gave me this huge plate of food. I'm probably sure I have to eat it in order to please him. And he cut me a big piece of cheesecake for dessert. I suspect that's what he thinks is a serving. So if it's a serving, I must have permission to eat the whole thing. Well, people, what you realize once you've developed metabolic flexibility is hunger no longer runs your life. It no longer drives you crazy from one meal to the next. You have a steady supply of energy. If you skip a meal or two or seven, nothing bad happens. You just go on about your day. You develop this ability to tap into stored body fat. So you trend toward your ideal body composition. Every meal that you skip is an opportunity for your body to start making repairs to itself. I mean, that's a bizarre new concept for a lot of people. And yet I think it's driving a lot of the research right now, this idea of autophagy and this idea of a house cleaning that takes place. I tell people in some of the talks that I give that all the good stuff happens to your body when you're not eating. You know, when you're eating, it's sort of an obligatory time to refill the stores and to, you know, load up on fuel. But all the really cool stuff happens when you're not eating. And if you can get that into your head and not feel like, oh my God, if I skip a meal, I'm going to faint. Or if I skip a meal, I'm going to go into cannibal mode. I'm going to start cannibalizing all the muscle I built in the gym. And if you can understand exactly how the body works and how metabolic flexibility works, those sorts of thoughts never enter your head. And then you realize, holy crap, my whole life, I have been eating way too much food. Now, I might have been able to get away with it. I might have been able to eat a lot of food and not gain weight or not look too bad, but maybe I had some additional inflammation. Maybe I got sick a little bit more often. Maybe I ran my body temperature at a higher level as the body tried to burn off some of the excess calories. Most people who develop metabolic flexibility find that they need probably 30% fewer calories now than they did last month or last year before they achieved this metabolic flexibility. It's a pretty empowering state to be in.
Mm. Well, what I love about that is we feel like food is the ultimate thing that we need to be eating each and every day. And obviously it is so important, but as you said, once that hunger disappears, then I guess you get to dictate how and when you eat and you listen to your body, which I think is fascinating. I do have a question for you. It's quite specific because I had a friend of mine who's a champion Ironman, actually, who's competing at the moment, asked me this question 2 days ago. And he adopted a paleo approach for quite some time until his parents pointed out that he looked too skinny. So he went off it to go back to carb loading and different approaches. And he's at that point now where he is struggling again with his diet and his energy levels. And as you know, an Ironman, they compete very and train very, very hard, very rigorously and expend a lot of energy. And he was saying, what should I do? And my first response is it a natural thing for the body to be doing that sort of training each and every day? And is that a normal thing, you know? And I didn't really have an answer for that. And I'd never really have the answer for people that do endurance sports, because from a simple point of view, it's like, or from my perception and perspective, it's like, well, is it a natural thing for our bodies to be going under that much stress and that much training each and every day, or however it is for a season? And I know that you've been involved in the sporting industry and working with athletes all your life. And I want to know how you would approach or give advice to this person that has this huge output of energy and wants to be able to have the energy, sustainable energy, to be able to meet his requirements.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real conundrum for me because, you know, I was an Ironman and I did do Ironman a couple times, and it's a very devastating training program. It is not good for you. It's not healthy. There's really no world in which Ironman training is beneficial to long-term health. It's in fact quite antithetical to health. Now, having said that, I wrote a book called Primal Endurance, where I recognize that there are a lot of people who want to do 10Ks and marathons and triathlons, and I don't want to prevent them. I don't want my point of view about that to discourage them from training. I just wanted to help them train in the best possible way, in the way that would do the least amount of long-term damage and possibly even have some short-term benefits to them. So mm-hmm. with your friend, I would, first of all, I'd call attention to my friend Sami Inkinen. Sami was one of the founders of Trulia, which is a real estate website that got bought by Zillow. And Sammy's always been sort of an autodidact and a top athlete. He's a good-sized boy. I mean, Sammy's 185 pounds. But his real breakthrough happened when he was 37 years old and he was the first amateur at the Wildflower Triathlon that he trained 11 hours a week total and did it basically on a ketogenic diet. So mm-hmm. what he recognized was that, first of all, he was training way too much. He was putting in way too much volume prior to this. And as a result, he was beat up all the time. And so he never had a chance to recover. Secondly, because he was using carb loading prior to that, he was just always carb dependent. He would run out of carbs. He hadn't trained his body to burn fat. When he became keto adapted and he realized that he could train at very high levels, burning mostly body fat, it opened a whole new world for him. So now he was at this point where he could do less volume and he could eat a high fat, low carb diet and win races. And now we're seeing it across the board. We're seeing the longer the race, the better a keto adapted athlete will do. But certainly a ketogenic training approach in something as long as 8, 9, 10 hours, an Ironman triathlon is, I think, the next wave of that's where the real breakthroughs are going to come. So, you know, I would have to, with your friend, I'd have to sit down and say, okay, let's look at your training schedule. How much volume are you doing? How much of that time is wasted training in what we call the black hole, for instance? The black hole is mm-hmm. an area where your heart rate is too high to be burning mostly fat. So you're burning mostly carbohydrate, but too low to be considered high intensity or anaerobic power. So you're in this zone where you're beating yourself up and you're not getting a training benefit from it. And it turns out that most triathletes and most marathon runners who don't know better spend a lot of time in this no man's land, in this black hole of training, which is not only not doing them any good, it's probably doing them a disservice in terms of beating them up. So again, I wrote a book called Primal Endurance. It covers a lot of that in terms of strategy and how you optimize your aerobic capacity by keeping your heart rate at 180 minus your age as a maximum training heart rate when you're out doing long rides or long runs. And then obviously a low carb eating strategy, which doesn't mean you can't carb up every once in a while. You could, if you've got an interval workout at the track tomorrow, you could have 150 grams of sweet potato and something else tonight and, you know, fill those glycogen stores and then go burn it all out tomorrow and still be metabolically flexible and still be able to make ketones and burn ketones and burn fat efficiently and all the things that you want to do.
Which is breaking out of ketosis for a day. Like it's called cyclical.
Yeah, it's not even a day. It's for a workout. You break out of ketosis. But here's the thing, Pete, and this is like my new theme here. The term ketosis is misused in this pursuit of better health. Ketosis basically means an excess of ketones in the bloodstream. When you become mm-hmm. keto adapted, when you become fat adapted and keto adapted, your body makes just enough ketones to fuel whatever it needs to fuel. And the rest, it burns fat and it makes whatever glucose it needs from gluconeogenesis. And so you could be keto for 10 years, never have more than 25 to 40 grams of carbs in a day and be so efficient at your manufacturing of ketones that you're never really in ketosis. You're never really wasting ketones. Because like ketosis almost means I'm wasting ketones. I'm making so many ketones that I can't use them efficiently. And so I'm spilling them out in my urine or spilling them out in my, in my breath or whatever. So that's that whole metabolic flexibility thing that we talk about where you can derive energy from whatever substrate happens to be handy because you've done the work. You've built the metabolic machinery to efficiently burn fats, to efficiently use ketones, to make ketones only to the extent that your body needs them and not waste them. And by the way, that's that whole point about using or needing fewer and fewer calories or getting by on less and less food is because when you become metabolically flexible, you also become metabolically efficient. And that efficiency, you know, imagine if you didn't eat for 2 days, but I've got 10% body fat, and you know, that's 20 pounds of maybe not 20 pounds, but whatever it is, it's 20 pounds of fat that I could live on if I had to, right? And I'm a fairly skinny guy. So if I didn't eat for a couple of days and I was keto adapted and fat adapted and had been doing the training and eating in this strategy and building this metabolic machinery, there would be no adverse effects. I would take the fat out of my fat stores. I would combust it in the muscles for energy in real time. Some of that fat I would send to the liver to become ketones that would then go to feed the brain. And the process of making those ketones would also upregulate some systems that spare protein. So I would not be wasting protein. I'd have this, I think you've heard this epigenetic result of ketosis or producing ketones is that there's a sparing of protein, a sparing of amino acids. So now you don't even need that much in the way of amino acids. You can get by on maybe, I don't know, your body might only need 40 or 45 grams of amino acids in a day. And that's even if you don't even have to eat food to have that amount of amino acids already circulating in your bloodstream because of the way the body does retain amino acids in different amino acid pools and sinks and things like that. So it's almost like you're a closed loop, a closed system for a couple of days, and you're able to derive energy from all these different substrates. I mean, look, the glucose can come from triglycerides that are sent to the liver. The three fatty acids are combusted as fuel, but the glycerol becomes a backbone for making glucose through gluconeogenesis. You have all these raw materials in your body that can that really kind of obviate the need to eat not just three times a day, but obviate the need to eat even every once in a while. And that's the ancestral pattern. You know, our ancestors didn't eat three square meals a day. Our ancestors barely ate once a day, right? Sometimes they didn't eat for 2 days. And, you know, did they get pissed off and hangry and moody and depressed and fear that they were going to go into cannibal mode? No. Well, maybe they did go into cannibal mode, but in a different way. but you know what I'm saying? It's like our DNA, our genes are set up to eat in a very sporadic fractal pattern. A little bit some days, none some days, a lot some days. And yet our bodies are also set up to be able to take the stored fuel and recycle it and burn it and combust it and use some of the spare parts as backbone for other types of fuel like glucose and ketones. It's a pretty amazing system that we have.
It is so amazing. And I guess when you, with all the information that you've just said, it is such a simple, I guess, approach once you're eating real food. I do want to touch on that, the endurance, and just briefly, and why do you think that it can be harmful for some people if they're pushing their bodies to that extreme? What's the science behind it? What's the realization behind that?
Well, the realization is, I'll give you a good example. I'm one of a generation that ran hard almost every day for 30 years. So going back, maybe even 40 years in my case, going back into the mid 70s when the running boom hit in the United States and I became a marathoner, you know, I spent 7 years training 100 miles a week on average for the marathon.
Wow.
Then when I got injured, I did triathlon because I had to do something with all of this, you know, endorphin. I was chasing the endorphin high all the time, right? So I spent a great amount of time. I ran my heart up to max every 3 times a week, 4 times a week for long periods of time for 30 years. As a result, I now have a thickened left ventricle, which manifests itself in premature ventricular contractions. So if I get my heart rate above 90 or 95, I go into a arrhythmia where my heart skips every third beat. It's annoying more than it is life-threatening, but it also it prevents me from doing any more competition. I couldn't compete anymore. I take meds for it, right? I take a calcium channel blocker for my heart. I was supposed to get an ablation, not supposed to, but an ablation is another thing that they do for atrial fibrillation, which is a related symptom of like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of runners and triathletes who have trained too hard over the years and done damage to their heart. The main reason I talk about this is the heart doesn't have really any innervation. The heart can't feel when, you know, you're overtaxing it the way, say, your bicep can. Like you go to the gym and if you try to do 300 repetitions of 50 pounds on the bicep curl every single day for a year, you think your biceps would know it? Yeah, they would, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah. then you tell yourself, I'm going to work my leg muscles and my arm muscles, and I'm going to run and ride my bike and swim, every day. And by the way, I'm going to carbo load that night, so I can go back and do it again the next day and carbo load again and keep doing this. And the heart goes, what are you doing? I'm just trying to keep up with the demand. The heart is just there to try to provide more oxygen and more fuel to the muscles that you are telling. You're making a conscious decision with your brain to run these leg muscles to run or cycle, but the heart doesn't have a say in it. The heart's just like trying to keep up. Well, over time, the heart gets, it gets abused. It gets stretched. It gets thickened. It gets, and we see a lot of that. I think it's an epidemic in runners and triathletes from the 70s and 80s right now.
Mm. And I mean, you are a beautiful specimen of a human being, a man in how you present yourself. And I'm always in awe whenever I see a photo of you. You look after yourself, Mark. And I'd love to know what your simple formula, if there is one, of how you look after your body at your age or any age. And what is that? Is it nourishment and not punishment, or a little bit of punishment? Or tell us your formula, if there is one that you go by these days.
Yeah, no, there is. So absolutely. We say abs are made in the kitchen, right? That's a little mantra that we all have here in the US. But if you have abs, you want to show them by not having a layer of fat over them. So we want to burn off stored body fat. But 80% of your body composition happens as a result of how you eat, not how you exercise. Now, that's not to say that you don't have to exercise. I mean, look, I still work out. And even though I talk about, my heart being what it is, I take meds for it, and I can still play sports, and I still, like, I play ultimate frisbee once a week. So I play a 2-hour game in the heat here in Miami, and I'm playing against 20 somethings and 30 somethings, and I can pretty much keep up with them most of the time. So that's my main workout, but it's fun, Pete. It's not drudgery. It's not like I'm out on the roads, running 15 miles, managing pain or managing discomfort. I'm having a blast the whole time. I do one session a week, sometimes two, of stand-up paddling. That's my favorite workout, actually, is a stand-up paddling. And I go hard. But stand-up paddling is such that you don't raise your heart rate that much, but you still work all the upper body, all the core, the lats, the pecs. You can even work the glutes. I mean, it's probably the stand-up paddling, if done right, is probably the perfect recreational exercise. I'd love to, like, one day when I retire, I have this sort of dream of going and teaching stand-up paddling in Bali or something, right? So that's how much I think of paddling. Then twice a week, I go to the gym, and I do ride a stationary bike in the gym. I go, by the way, to read a book. I don't go to ride a bike. I just happen to be riding a bike while I'm reading, but that's when I do so in my reading. And I'll ride for 40 minutes twice a week, and then I'll do two fairly high intense lifting sessions per week in the gym. But they're not, they're only contemplated to keep me injury free from the other things that I do. Like, I don't want to get injured playing ultimate because I'm sprinting hard, changing direction, doing a lot of things that a 65-year-old man probably ought not to be doing, but damn it, I'm going to do it as long as I can. So as a totality, I'm the consummate cross trainer, right? I'm doing sprints while I'm playing ultimate. I'm doing upper body work while I'm paddling. I'm doing cycling in the gym on a life cycle. And then I'm doing, like today, I did deadlifts. I'm a big fan of hex bar deadlifts because I want to maintain my core that way. The other day I did a bunch of planks, and I was sore from that in a good way. I'm always trying to mix it up, but never trying to get into a rut of the same thing day in and day out.
So it sounds like you have a lot of fun doing the exercises for you to look and feel the way that you want to look and feel.
Fun's got to be the operative word, Pete. It has to be fun. It's not sustainable if it's not fun.
Mm. I mean, one of my goals is to be surfing when I'm 100. I'm looking forward because I love doing it. So I guess you also are a big proponent, from what I can gather, of being outdoors in the sun as well. And it was interesting. I posted an Instagram story 2 days ago saying that I love looking at the sun at sunrise and sunset wherever I can, just briefly. And just really appreciating this beautiful thing. And next day, we have this great media in this country where they like to say they bring a doctor on and say, you shouldn't have a look at the sun and you should spend too much time in the sun, and Pete's crazy. And
Yeah, but Pete's been crazy for a long time. We know that.
Yeah.
Crazy in a good way.
Because nobody should admire a sunset or a sunrise ever again because the doctor said you should never look at it. Yeah. But I'd love to get your understanding of the sun and how important it is for you, because whenever I see you, you seem to have a deep appreciation and respect, I should say, of the sun.
Well, I do have a respect for the sun. So I'm in Miami now. I live in Miami Beach. And, you know, the sun is pretty brutally hot here. I love the heat. Heat doesn't do anything. But, you know, to be out in the middle of the day, you still have to be somewhat careful. I mean, I do not want to burn. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of vitamin D. I think vitamin D is one of the most overlooked markers for health in most people. And I, you know, sun is critical for the manufacture of vitamin D. So some amount of unprotected exposure to the sun on a daily basis, I think, is a good thing. But I also think you have to be mindful of where you are and how much, you know, what the UV index is on the rays that you're getting for that day. I actually keep an app on my phone that tells me what the UV index is. And, you know, I wear a hat when I'm out paddling. I wear sunscreen when I'm out paddling because I know I'm going to be out longer than would be appropriate. Mm. And I have a misspent youth where I was a contractor and spent 10 years out working in the sun every day with my shirt off. So, you know, I have some of those little precancerous things that have to be burned off every once in a while. Again, as you, when you get older, Pete, you'll encounter that. So, you know, so I see a dermatologist 3 times a year just to get checked out. That doesn't mean I'm afraid of the sun. I love the sun, and I think everybody should spend some amount of time in the sun on a daily basis if they have access to it.
Yeah, well said. Well said. We've covered a lot, mate. We've talked about eating. We've talked about that metabolic flexibility. We've also talked about working out and a good formula for both of those things. We've talked about some sun. And we've also talked about your business and the way that you're doing some amazing things in the world to not only change the way people can purchase food and shop, but also where they're getting their information from. And I guess I'd like to finish off on that as far as information, because there seems to be a lot of misinformation out there in the mainstream media, even in certain health philosophies as well. And I'd like for you to sum it up best on how best to navigate so much conflicting information. If this is the first podcast anybody's ever listened to about health, and what you've been saying is very opposite to what somebody's doctor or a dietitian might say, what's your advice to somebody?
Well, that's a tough question to answer in a way that I think would be as meaningful as you probably anticipate, because, you know, people are so tied to, first of all, to their way of eating. People are more tied to their way of eating than they are to their religion that they're born into. I mean, people defend their eating choices so aggressively. So, you know, when people say, well, I'm looking at becoming, you know, a vegan, you're going to talk to a vegan crowd that's going to be like overwhelmingly, you know, oh, you have to be vegan. You have to do this. You have to, this will be great. You'll love it. Then you talk to a paleo crowd and they'll say the same thing. And you talk to a gluten-free crowd and they'll say the same thing. So I think it's like what I tried to do with Mark's Daily Apple is I've tried to be as objective in my reporting as possible. And as you said, in the early parts of this podcast, as open-minded. I've changed my mind on a couple of things over the years. Mm. And I would say, you know, go to Mark's Daily Apple and start reading some of the articles going back through history. But at the end of the day, I think you pick, I mean, I hate to say it. I hate to put in these terms. You pick your guru. You pick who resonates with you the most and start following that person. And so if it's, you know, if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, you might pick, you know, a Rich Roll. At the end of the day, there are no right answers, Pete. There are just, there are just opinions based on what that person perceives to be the current thinking or the current science. So I would say that people who are vegans and defend their way of eating against paleo or ancestral eating, I would say, well, the reason that both of these ways of eating do have some benefits is it's because you've given up a lot of the crap. So it's the stuff you're not eating that's making a big difference in your health, not the stuff that you are eating. Not, it's not your choice of protein that's making the difference. It's that you're giving up of artificial sweeteners and artificial ingredients and giving up industrial seed oils and all that other stuff that's having the first level of impact on your health. And so I'm almost, you know, I'm not going to say I'm agnostic in terms of what, if I meet somebody and they say, well, they're a mindful vegan, I'm like, great, go for it. I love that. You know, I'm not going to give you grief about your choices. As long as you're mindful about it and you know what you're not eating and you're being, you know, again, mindful of where you're getting your protein from and whatever source of good fats you're eating, then I'm not going to have any beef with that. I don't want people to be blindly following some program and realize that it was a mistake and that their health deteriorated because they didn't do enough research going in and didn't fully embrace the best benefits of that way of eating.
Yeah, well said, mate. Well said. And I think you summed it up quite well, like follow the people that you want to follow. But I'll put that back to you as follow yourself and listen to your body and see what works best for yourself, because what works for one may not work for the other.
No, that's a great point. I mean, there are a number of people that I know, and I'm one of them. I mean, I did 90 days as a vegetarian years ago. Didn't work for me, but I did the experiment, you know, and I learned some things from it. And I think this whole concept of, you know, getting to know yourself and the idea of an experiment of one is a great reference point. And if, as long as you pay attention, as long as you're not just messing around, if you're going to do a scientific experiment, do an experiment, you know, eliminate certain things, make notes, see how you look, feel and perform, you know, reintroduce things one at a time and be mindful of it. But that's probably the best way to go about it. Yeah.
I love it. And I guess we should finish up with a question that I ask all my guests is what's Mark Sisson's, you know, an ingredient for your recipe of life that you would love to share with the audience? And it can be on any topic or any philosophy that it's something that you implement either on a daily or weekly, or it's a philosophy for life for you.
Well, you know, we have this tagline at my company. It's called Live Awesome, you know, and it's trying to extract the greatest amount of pleasure, contentment, fulfillment, enjoyment from every moment possible. So it's seeking the best in every opportunity, even though it might be perceived initially as a downer, right? It's looking for growth and opportunity whenever you can. It's certainly looking for pleasure and fulfillment and contentment on those obvious moments, but also trying to find it in the ones that are not so obvious.
I love it. Hey, I just want to thank you for today. It's been an awesome opportunity to chat to you one-on-one yet again and get up to date with where you're at in changing the world. And I just want to say that I love you, mate, and our listeners love you, and keep being awesome. And I can't wait to cook another steak with you again in the future, brother.
Well, the invitation's always on, and and same. I mean, I think you're doing a great job, and don't let the haters, affect you negatively. I know sometimes, you know, you put it out there, you put your heart on the sleeve, and then you get, you know, a little backlash on it. But that only means you're doing what you're doing, and you're successful at it. So you keep up the great work too, mate.
Well, it's been a beautiful morning. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here, and I've been sitting in the sun for an hour while I'm doing this podcast. So I've already had an awesome day and a beautiful tea with my wife this morning too. Thank you, Mark. And until we meet again, be awesome.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.